Alzheimer's disease is the most common type of dementia. It's a progressive disease, beginning with mild memory loss, possibly leading to the loss of an ability to carry on a conversation and to respond with awareness to the environment. Ultimately, Alzheimer's disease can lead to death. It involves parts of our brain that control our thoughts, our memory, and our language, and it can very seriously affect a person's ability to carry out daily activities, and it affects the entire family. In 2020, it is estimated that 5.8 million Americans are living with Alzheimer's disease. Younger people may get it, but primarily, this is a disease of the elderly. The number of people living with the disease doubles for every 5 years past the age of 65. Because of the aging boomer population, the number of people diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease is expected to triple to 14 million people by the year 2060. Symptoms of the disease can first appear after the age of 60, and as you get older, the risk increases. Changes in the brain begin years before the symptoms first appear, but unfortunately, there's not a lot of research about education, diet, and the environment, so it's critically important that we enhance our healthy behaviors many years before the onset of symptoms. We know that a healthy lifestyle may reduce the risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. Getting a good nutritious diet, limiting alcohol consumption, not smoking tobacco, and getting adequate physical activity may prevent those, even those who are genetically designed to get Alzheimer's disease, from having serious disease later in life. I mentioned that the whole family is involved, and we're going to talk today not only about the disease and how to prevent it, but how family and friends can most effectively care for their loved ones throughout the entire progression of disease. This is The Lindsay Elmore Show. Welcome to The Lindsay Elmore Show, a podcast for people who deserve to be healthy, with honest, open, and enlightening conversations with doctors, thought leaders, creatives, and spiritual gurus. You'll walk away with simple and tangible tips and tricks that allow you to live your healthiest life so you can pursue your dreams, overcome obstacles, and leave your mark. By now, everyone's heard of CBD oil. While some people swear by it, others have not seen the results they were hoping for. And that is where Eaton Hemp comes in. They offer unfiltered, USDA-certified organic full-spectrum CBD oil that is minimally processed and infused with their own hemp seed oil. This allows you to get the full entourage effect, as well as maximum absorption, potency, and effectiveness. All of that means results. Not only does Eaton provide one of the cleanest CBD products on the market, but they pride themselves on transparency. Eaton Hemp is farmer-owned and strongly believes in whole plant nutrition. That's why they leave the CBD unfiltered, so all of the elements of the hemp plant can work in unison. Eaton Hemp is so confident in the results that their CBD will offer you, they will give you a full 30-day money-back guarantee, no questions asked. So if you aren't satisfied with the product, they'll refund you. No problem. As a special offer for our podcast listeners, you can save 25% on all Eaton Hemp products and still get your full money-back guarantee when you head to www.eatonhemp.com www.eatonhemp.com/Lindsay Elmore Show. That's www.eatonhemp.com/Lindsay Elmore Show to save 25%. Be sure to use the show's link so that Eaton Hemp knows that we sent you. Head to www.eatonhemp.com/Lindsay Elmore Show and shop now. Dr. Shaliza Shori is a licensed neuropsychologist in private practice. In addition to her clinical work, she has been involved in teaching assessment seminars to postdoctorate students as a part of her role on the medical staff at El Camino Hospital. Dr. Shori serves as an independent consultant to physicians and mental health providers working with patients who have chronic pain and neuropsychological conditions. Her areas of expertise include pain management and neuropsychology, including EMDR, neuro and biofeedback. Dr. Shori also has a strong interest in developing value-based, multidisciplinary programs for better managing chronic conditions. She is the founder and CEO of Epiphany, a telehealth company focusing on improving care for mental health and chronic conditions. She is passionate about promoting value-based care that helps individuals become self-efficacious and feel empowered. She is the president of the American Association of Pain Psychology, an organization that is focused on spreading knowledge about how we can better manage chronic pain conditions. Today, we focus on one neuropsychological condition, Alzheimer's disease. Dr. Shaliza Shori, welcome to the Lindsay Elmore Show.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be here.
I'm excited to chat because I think Alzheimer's disease is a very feared diagnosis. It is a huge burden on families, and it is a huge, it is exceptionally difficult to care for a patient with Alzheimer's disease because people get lost, they wander, they struggle, they forget things. And oftentimes I think children become the primary care providers and they are in that situation of having to parent their parents, which is also very difficult. I also think that people don't understand that Alzheimer's doesn't always cause dementia and it can ultimately lead to death. We see 120,000 people a year die from Alzheimer's disease, and we also know it's the sixth leading cause of death in the United States. And so talk to us first about what is Alzheimer's disease? What are the risk factors that lead to Alzheimer's disease? And just give us a little bit of a crash course so that we understand the disease state better.
Absolutely. And this might get a little technical, but I'm going to try to keep it pretty high level. So Alzheimer's, the first signs of it were first noted in 1906 by Dr. Alzheimer's. He was a German psychiatrist, and he noticed some strange findings in one of his patients' brains. And then it wasn't until 1980s that we really sort of started to look at what are these strange substances in the brain. So let me first start out by just sort of saying what happens in a healthy brain, and then I'll explain what happens in Alzheimer's. So in a healthy brain, we have, you know, about 100 billion neurons, and these neurons have these long kind of extensions coming off of them, which are called axons. And between each neuron, there's this empty space called the synapse, where chemicals are released, and that's how neurons communicate with each other. And that's how our brains communicate with each other, is through these neurotransmitters and sending messages back and forth. Now, what happens in Alzheimer's is that you start to get these beta amyloid plaques inside the neurons, and you also get these abnormally formed proteins called the tau protein outside, starting to kind of cause these tangles and plaques in the brain that are really interfering with this communication. So, you know, think about it like your freeways are all jammed up. No one's getting anywhere. There's disconnects. So eventually, and this can start to happen, Lindsay. The interesting thing is this can start to happen about 15 to 20 years before people see any symptoms. And we call that the preclinical stage. And it's not until sort of that stage has been progressing that we start to then see some cognitive deficits, right? Because I think most people start to recognize Alzheimer's or dementia. So dementia is the broader term, by the way. Alzheimer's is one type of a dementia, because I think people often get confused between, well, what about this? What about that? So there's many different types of dementias. I'm not going to go into all of them today because each one has its own whole sort of topic we could talk about. We're going to focus on Alzheimer's, but it's a type of a dementia that can come about from Alzheimer's disease. It's not always that people would develop Alzheimer's dementia from Alzheimer's disease, but it's a type of dementia. That makes sense?
Yes, absolutely. So, not all dementias are Alzheimer's dementias, but all Alzheimer's is dementia. Does that make, yeah.
So
And
the
I
stages, like on a high level, would be preclinical, where you don't have any symptoms. Then you sort of have Alzheimer's disease, where you start to see mild cognitive impairment, right? And then sometimes people can just, the course really varies. And I think that's one of the things I want your listeners to understand is don't panic at any point, because it ranges in terms of how it might affect a person. So it's important to just sort of go to what are you experiencing? What do you need support with or your family? Because it can really vary. So we can see people with Alzheimer's disease that will not progress to Alzheimer's dementia. And for many people, it does. Within about 2 to 5 years, it progresses to Alzheimer's dementia once we have that mild cognitive impairment.
Absolutely. And I think many of our listeners, thinking about these synapses and communication, I think a lot of listeners are familiar with the SSRI drugs, the Prozacs of the world, et cetera. And those drugs are working within that synapse. And so listeners, if you understand the mechanism of action of many antidepressant medicines, that's what we're talking about, is that communication that goes on. So what happens that leads to Alzheimer's? Like, what are the causes of Alzheimer's disease?
So probably the biggest one is genetic. It does tend to run in families, right? So, which is not that different from diabetes or cardiovascular illness. So we are unfortunately all sort of, at the mercy of our genes. But now, having said that, we can carry genetic vulnerabilities, and it doesn't mean it's always going to manifest, right? And the other sort of major things that we found is head injuries. This is why it's so important that we are paying attention to the young athletes, for example, right? So somebody who's had repeated head injuries is potentially going to be more at risk than somebody who's never had head injuries. Chronic sleep deprivation has shown, disturbed sleep rhythms are commonly found in Alzheimer patients. That's one of the big symptoms, is their sleep patterns are really off. And people who are chronically sleep deprived, less than 7 hours of sleep a night, are putting themselves at higher risk of Alzheimer's. Poor cardiovascular health, believe it or not. I'm sure people are sick of hearing exercise, exercise, but I'm sorry, it really is a fantastic answer to so many things. And the reason that cardiovascular health matters is because when you're in good cardiovascular shape, it's the same blood supply up to your brain that's carrying the fresh nutrients, removing the toxins from the brains, right? So it's the same circulation system. And when that system is not working well, it increases your chances of brain atrophy as well, right? So all of those things matter. And I also want to kind of say, in terms of risk factors for women, because I know a lot of your audience are women listeners, is two-thirds of all Alzheimer patients are women. And some of the risk factors, increased risk factors for women tend to be, women live longer. So that's probably another, along with genetics, one of the biggest risk factors is aging. Alzheimer's is usually diagnosed in people over 65, right? And maybe even a little bit later. So women do tend to live longer. But aside from that, I think a lot of women are the ones who are caregivers for people who are living with Alzheimer's disease. And there's a lot of burdens in being a caregiver. It's a very stressful role, right? So oftentimes women will be sleep deprived. They will not take care of themselves in the same ways, or they will ignore symptoms, because menopause can look so similar, right? There's sleep disturbance, there are mood changes, there's mental fog, which can sort of mimic each other. So that's the other thing I really want to say is, if you're having these symptoms, talk to someone, because It's really, really confusing for people to try to sort through and navigate through what is normal aging, what is menopause, what is some thyroid condition potentially, right? Versus what is truly a dementia process that's setting in or starting.
So talk to us about how we can differentiate those things. And, you know, if you have problems 15 to 20 years in advance, it seems like that these symptoms must come, they creep in. You know, it's not like having a heart attack. This is a chronic debilitating condition. So what are some of the earliest symptoms that you go, this is not just forgetfulness, this is Alzheimer's?
Right. So the first 15 to 20 years, people are not even going to know unless they happen to go in for some reason for a PET scan or some sort of a spinal cord fluid test where they're seeing these proteins in the fluid. People don't have any symptoms. They are very high functioning. They're living their lives the way they would normally be living. Kind of around the age of 65 or older, if you start to have forgetfulness, where so what some of, I'm going to give you some distinguishing factors so people can understand. What we often see in patients who are truly starting to develop a dementia process is the lack of awareness. You know, we in the clinical world laugh that if a patient's being brought in by their family and they're coming in saying, "I don't have a problem, it's probably dementia," and the patient who's coming in saying, "Gosh, doc, what's wrong with my memory?" probably is depressed and is probably not dementing. Right?
Okay.
So the point is that our frontal lobes that help us with awareness, that help us with kind of the planning organization aspects or foresight, are also affected in dementia. So we're not really fully aware of sort of what's happening, but family members will pick up on that. So family members can help sort of say, okay, this has happened. So the frequency is one thing. If it's happening fairly frequently, that's not part of normal aging. Part of normal aging, people can have forgetfulness here or there, but the biggest difference is they will later say, "Oh goodness, I had a senior moment," or, "Oh shoot, I had that appointment earlier today and I forgot about it." Right? So you see that awareness continues through normal aging, whereas in a dementing process, you're not going to see that awareness present anymore. So that's probably the biggest distinguisher because it is something that affects memory. Poor judgment is another one. Poor judgment is not part of normal aging. In fact, people get wiser, as we say, right? As they get older. So your judgment doesn't typically falter. You can have some things that are similar to dementias, which is the word finding issue, for example, right? Where, gosh, I just can't think of the right word, or the speech becomes more vague because I can't think of the right language, because language is another area that's affected in Alzheimer's. But again, in normal aging, those things are infrequent, and then eventually your brain will, the connection may be slower, but they'll make that connection eventually. So that's the biggest difference, is that you're not having that awareness, or that thing doesn't come back around for you because it never was consolidated into your long-term memory.
Okay. So there's actually not just problems with communication. I like what you just said because we do, during our sleep, consolidate all of those memories. And that's one reason sleep is so important, and also just glymphatic drainage that happens while we're asleep as well. Now, let's talk about the family member that's bringing in this older loved one who is making poor decisions, doesn't have any awareness that, you know, hey, dad, wandering off is not a good thing to do. And they're noticing more and more forgetfulness. How can you, let's start at the very beginning. How can this family member approach their loved one and say, "Dad, mom, I think it's time for us to go to a doctor about this"? How do you start having those conversations?
Yeah, no, that is really hard. And that is one of the reasons that the diagnosis get pushed out, because the person's scared. And oftentimes, Lindsay, they're scared, especially in the early stages, is because they may be like, okay, something's off, but they're afraid. Am I not going to be able to live independently anymore? Is my driver's license going to get taken away, right? That's a big source of freedom for people, and that's a really scary thought. Or am I not going to be allowed to make my own decisions anymore? Or for some people, if they're still working, am I going to lose my job? So they'd rather not deal with it. They'd rather not look at the problem. So what I'd suggest for family members who are sort of noticing some things and they're not sure, one is that I think most Medicare, Medi-Cal services after the age of 65 cover at least a cognitive screen, even at your wellness check every year. So, you know, one thing could be you could just let your parents' primary care physician know that, you know, I'm a bit concerned about their memory. Can you first just start out by doing even a screen at a regular wellness visit that most people do go to? So I think that can be a fantastic start, because in that, if the doctor starts to notice, the primary care physician notices that, okay, your numbers are perhaps in the mild deficit or moderate deficit range, let's explore this further. Then they would involve a neuropsychologist like me. They would involve a neurologist perhaps, right? But the primary care physician can be your hub for sort of bringing those things in. Mm-hmm. And two is, I always tell people, and even I as a professional will often start with people when they come to my office with wherever they're willing to start. You know, your daughter mentioned you're not sleeping so well lately. You know, we all need sleep, and let's see if we can sort of help you with just addressing some things to see what's happening with your sleep. Is that okay if we talk about your sleep a little bit, right? And within that, you can sort of start to explore some other areas, or mood is another one, right? So people can, when you're frequently losing things, you can't find where you place things, you're losing your way, you start to become a bit agitated and paranoid as to, you know, there's a distrust, and that can bring on about agitation. So you could start with, you know, your daughter or your son mentioned that lately you've been having kind of difficulties in your relationship with them, or your mood hasn't been great. Let's talk a bit more about that. You don't have to go straight to, hey, we hear you're having memory problems. For any of us.
Yeah, I mean, because nobody wants to hear that something is wrong with them, you know? I am a huge fan of meeting people where they are. And so if people are not willing to address all of it, at least we can address some of the underlying root causes. You know, we can say like, hey, your cardiovascular health is not looking good. And so, and sleep is just the other thing that I think is one of those great, great things that we can encourage. Now, you just mentioned agitation. And I remember back when I was in pharmacy school, when we were taught all of the medications for Alzheimer's dementia, which I would love to hear your opinion on, because in my clinical experience, they don't work that well, because it's not dealing with the root cause. It's not dealing with the fact that your brain is jammed up with tau proteins as in beta amyloid plaques. So you mentioned agitation, and I remember when I was in pharmacy school, they showed us a photo in that Alzheimer's lecture. And they said, this is what Alzheimer's kind of looks like that's different than normal aging. There is almost like a confusion, a hauntedness, a like there's a lack of that awareness. Like you said, the patients kind of fold.
They're very disoriented.
Yeah, they kind of fold into themselves, and it's like, well, what is going on? But patients also can become agitated and even violent because of Alzheimer's disease. And so how do you coach caregivers on how do they deal with the agitation, the disorientation, the confusion, and if there is violence, then what?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this is where I do think, you know, you and I were talking before the show started about kind of the multidisciplinary component. This is where I think it does take a team approach. So the caregivers should, by all means, speak up and ask for help from the medical system, from the mental health system. But to deal with that is, in the initial early stages, you'll see a little bit more of what you said, the withdrawn affect, the disorientation, just especially to time, kind of just not feeling like you know what's happening around you. And in the later stages is when somebody can become agitated because they're becoming paranoid at this point because nothing's adding up. right? They feel like people are stealing from them. They feel like they can't trust anybody. They can't recognize even a family member, right? What gives us a sense of safety? What gives us a sense of trust is a familiar face, as they say. Well, guess what? Nobody's face is familiar anymore. So of course you're feeling so lost, so paranoid and alone in the world and agitated. It is a really hard place to be. So matching where the person is at with the level of care. So in the early stages of dementia, for example, we can have mild, moderate, and severe, right? So in a mild stage, the person may still be able to function well in their home with a caregiver, with some assistance. Labeling things can be a huge help. So you put cups, plates, right? You help simplify their environment. Driving is often a safety issue, right? So kind of lining up services so their freedom is not limited, but they can still get some from place A to B in a safe way, but not making them too isolated. So, you know, you meet them where they're at. Again, in the moderate stages, they may need a little bit more care. And in the severe stages is where you really do require around the clock care, the 24/7. And those are the stages where you'd probably see somebody being the most agitated. And I do think that it is important for families to have that conversation about, is residential placement perhaps the most safe place for that person to be and most doable for the family, right? Because it is a system altogether. The family is a system. And you want to make sure that all the different members of a family system are supported in these situations. And in the later stages, I do think that, you know, now we have more and more facilities that can help people. And partly because, you know, with the baby boomer population aging, the numbers for Alzheimer's and dementias are expected to rise. Mm-hmm. So with that, there are more facilities. We are learning more. There are more resources. The American Alzheimer's Association is a fantastic resource for people to go to their website and kind of get resources from there. But your primary care physician of the person who's being inflicted with the dementia is always a good place to start.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they can do those cognitive screens. They can help you to understand and then help you to really understand if you need a higher level of care. Whenever patients enter into the medical system, it is confusing, overwhelming, hard to navigate. It's very much kind of like, where am I? What is going on? And I say that even as a pharmacist who is very familiar with the medical system, but being able to navigate is very difficult. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsors. Have you been feeling like your energy is not what it used to be, or that you just can't think as clearly as you once did, or maybe that stress is just always surrounding you and impacting your mood and your behavior? You may be struggling with your overall mental fitness. Mental fitness is not just about brain power. It's about how do we center our focus, gain more confidence, become more resilient towards stress, and improve our physical performance alongside our mental performance. Inside of Amare's Mental Fitness Pack, you'll find three products specifically designed to help improve brain performance, increase energy and endurance, while simultaneously calming the body and brain, helping to lower stress so that you can think more clearly and have a healthy, positive mood. Inside of the Mental Fitness Pack, there are three products. There is Energy Plus, which delivers rapid improvements in both brain and physical performance. There is the Mood Plus, which I can personally attest helped me to have fewer feelings of anxiousness and reduced my restlessness and overall stress levels in just one dose. Then there's the Sleep Plus, which is going to help you to fall asleep faster and stay asleep longer. Believe it or not, mental fitness can also lead to pain. So there is a fourth product in here called Relief Plus that has been scientifically shown to help improve sports recovery and joint health while providing fast-acting and long-lasting relief from occasional aches and pains, which can help you to sleep better, overall enhancing your mental fitness. Get shopping now at lindsayelmore.com/amare. When you shop my link, you will save $10. And when you subscribe and save, you will get an additional 10% off. When you get started with the Mental Fitness Pack, you will be on your way to have improved brain performance and a calmer body and brain. Shop now at lindsayelmore.com/amare to save $10. And now, let's get back to the show. And so, you mentioned that you're a huge advocate of interdisciplinary care, multidisciplines. It's not just like the psychiatrist gives you a prescription for donepezil and you're out the door. So talk to us about, I can imagine occupational therapists would have a great role here. I can imagine that, you know, people who are there to help you heal those root causes. So if someone is like diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, it sounds to me like early interventions are gonna be very critical. So talk to us about like, all right, families, here's your checklist. I want you to go see this person, this person, this person, and this person so that you can get a comprehensive care plan for your loved one.
Right. And I'm actually gonna sort of put that in a context of because of those pain points, right? So I used to work in hospital systems where everybody was at least under the same roof. And you had a shared electronic medical record system, so you could sort of, you know, talk to each other a bit more easily. I don't know what it's like in your area, but definitely in our area, it's not uncommon for most of these providers to be in their own independent practices. So now no one's under the same roof. So the conversation has gotten even more fragmented between these doctors, and it becomes the caregiver's burden to run from this doctor to that doctor to that doctor. And I've seen it for over, you know, I've been a clinician for over 20 years, and it's just heartbreaking to watch these poor families who are already dealing with a lot on a day-to-day basis, caring for the person with the disease, but on top of that, like you said, trying to navigate the system. So about a year and a half ago, I actually started building a platform, which is a multidisciplinary platform where we have primary care physicians, pediatricians, mental health providers, neuropsychologists like myself. And we can all securely talk to each other with the family's permission, taking that burden off of the patients, right? And then the patients subscribe to one main person who's their point person on the platform, sort of like their therapist or their case manager, who is communicating with them, but then that person's communicating with the whole team. So first thing is I would say to families, don't try to be everywhere. You know, it can be a lot because you go to a doctor's office and they give you a slip. Well, go to this department, call radiology for imaging, call the neurologist for this, right? Go to the pharmacy for that. And gosh, it is really overwhelming. So do request and see where can they kind of bring this care together for you as a team. And you have one point person that you're dealing with because that can really help. So that is one piece of it. Two is peer support systems, right? Get plugged into other folks, other families who've gone through this. And like I said, the Alzheimer's Association is a great resource for that. Look for your resources in your local community. Oftentimes there are rehabilitation or memory care centers, they're called, right? So a social worker at a memory care center, for example, can often be your point person who can help guide you in terms of here are the resources. So really don't feel like you have to do it alone, because if you haven't gone through it before, how are you supposed to know how to successfully navigate this, right? So reaching out for that support sometimes in navigating the system can be very helpful rather than just trying to navigate it yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Having somebody that can coordinate all that care can be a huge shift, a huge weight off of your shoulders, because you are so right. One of the major breakdowns of medicine in the United States is the fact that the right hand doesn't know what the left is doing. It is really hard when the cardiologist has no clue what the psychiatrist is doing. The pharmacist can barely get through to a doctor to be like, I don't think this medicine is correct. What is going on? So it is very, very challenging. And you're right. I love what you said about don't try to be everywhere. Don't try to be everywhere. Let's shift and pivot now. And let's talk about foods, diet. You know, if somebody's diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, what are you encouraging them? We've talked a lot about sleep and about exercise, but what are you encouraging your patients to eat? Have there been any foods or supplements that have been robustly studied in the treatment of Alzheimer's?
Well, you know how the supplement industry is. I do think there's a lot of things out there that can be helpful, but it's not regulated, right? So in that sense, unless it has that FDA approval, it becomes very hard for researchers or for us as clinicians to be able to say this has great science behind it, because oftentimes it's just not being looked at the same way. Mm-hmm. But I do think that there's a lot of things that we can do if we know that that genetic vulnerability runs in our family. Just like I said earlier, that if I know diabetes runs in my family, monitoring my blood glucose, eating the right foods is going to increase my chances of success, right? So if you know that Alzheimer's runs in your family, some of the other things is, this might come as a surprise to people and got really tough during COVID, is social connections. Healthy social connections are fantastic for our nervous system. And you know, our brain is part of our nervous system. They've done lots of research to see who does well with chronic conditions. So as you know, the other hat I wear is as a chronic pain psychologist, but in that they've looked at, you know, when people are living with these chronic conditions or progressive degenerative conditions, how do we sort of gauge their functional outcomes? Who's living well despite these conditions? It wasn't their medication and it wasn't the medical interventions they were getting. It was their support system. Mm-hmm. People who had more robust social systems, social communities, actually are living much better. So, you know, do spend time with girlfriends, do spend time with friends and family that make you feel good, right? Mm-hmm. So that's a big protective factor that I think doesn't get discussed enough in our society. And then in terms of foods, you know, amino acids, that's what our brain is made of. So yeah. I do think that that's a very good thing to kind of fish, right? We've heard a lot about fish oils and a pescatarian diet, healthy oils. Our brain needs those things.
Absolutely. I was just chatting with Dr. Shilpa Saxena the other day, and she was telling me that one of the reasons that a lot of antidepressant drugs don't really work that well is because you've spent so many years either in depression, bipolar disorder, alcoholism, you know, drug abuse, you burn all your neurotransmitters and then you like can't build them without the amino acids. And so she really taught me that if you've got problems with your brain, like amino acids, and you know, I think it's really important. As after I talked to her, I was like, I am going to start taking an amino acid supplement just because I want my brain to have that nutrition. Absolutely.
There's the amino acids, but then there's just healthy foods too. Like for example, flaxseed, mm-hmm. right? Something that's readily available. It's affordable. It's something people can incorporate into their own diet, right? So there are kind of natural things that we can just sort of put here and there as well. And I agree with what you're saying, that oftentimes people don't think about the fact that what we do throughout our life is going to show up, right? The body is amazing in that, and the brain, you're not going to see immediate effects of it. So if I ate badly today or even for a few months, it's not like the detriments are going to come right there. If I've lived a lifestyle that didn't have these preventative measures, I'm going to see the outcomes of them much later on. Mm-hmm. And that is an issue. That is really something I think we have to sort of advocate for in the younger generation to help them understand. Mm-hmm. Because often people can have the short-sightedness that, oh yeah, I'm fine. I mean, I did this for so many years and I'm still fine. But if you stay on that trajectory, it manifests later on, right? You don't develop a cholesterol problem right away because you ate something wrong the day before, or a month before. Mm-hmm. So prevention, I do think, is huge. And I advocate a lot for prevention in my work with people. And I just think as a nation, unfortunately, we're very focused on rehabilitation and not as much on prevention. But if people can honestly sort of just do these things all along, you're really increasing your own chances of success as you age.
Absolutely. I mean, it is so important. I think in Chinese medicine, you go to the doctor so that you don't get sick, you know, and in Ayurveda as well, you go to the doctor so you don't get sick. We don't have that in the United States. We poo-poo the idea that self-care is valuable. But in my interview with Dr. Sarah Gottfried, one of the things that she talked about is that sleep is like a bank account. And the more you pour into that bank account, the greater longevity you're going to have, the more, the less cognitive decline, all of the things. And so sleep is so powerfully, powerfully important. And so we've talked a lot about prevention. I would like to talk now about the challenges of end-of-life care. We have spoken on the podcast with Beth Cavanaugh, who is a hospice nurse. And so talk to our listeners who may be facing either an imminent death or what unfortunately can be a long protracted illness that ultimately leads to death. How do you counsel caregivers around the time of death?
Yeah, I'll address that, but I'll also go a little bit before that, because I think one of the things is when you're at imminent death, again, we as a society have come together around that. Hospice services are some of the best and organized services, quite frankly, around the country, right? Mm-hmm. And there's coverage for that, there's support. Everybody sort of can come together around hospice. So I do think that there is a lot of good support at that time of death and dying. Mm-hmm. But it's that journey up to that point where people are left on their own. So I really do that notion of sort of bank account, as you just said. I talk to families a lot about, hey, you're saving for retirement, you're making all these other plans. If you know that you have certain genetic vulnerabilities, or you're even been diagnosed with mild cognitive impairment, for example, right? That's the early stage, as I was saying, start the planning then. Mm-hmm. What's the worst case scenario? You may not need the plan. It's like a living will, I say to people, right? If we have a living will, I know who's going to make my decisions, who will be in charge. And so I can actually live more freely today. Mm-hmm. People sometimes think these things are morbid to talk about, or, oh, I don't want to think about that. I don't want to plan for that. That's so morbid. It actually is not morbid. It actually frees your mind up to live an easier life today. Mm-hmm. So if somebody does get diagnosed with mild cognitive impairment, I would encourage the family to start thinking about those decisions then, when the person can still have some say. Who should be your medical advocate? Who should make those decisions for you? Who do you trust to manage your finances for you, right? How would you like things handled? Would you like to die in your home? Have that conversation, right? So have hospice brought in versus being in a facility. Now, depending on the progression of the illness, sometimes we don't always have that much control or choice around it, but at least start with choice, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Start with these discussions and a very good plan in place. I always say to people, having a plan is not going to hurt you. You may not need it, right? That's the worst case scenario. If you have a good plan, okay, I just didn't need it. Well, that's fine. That's great. But if in case you do need it, it's there. Mm-hmm. So how to kind of plan towards that if the situation goes there is just really thinking through, how would that person like their life stage, last stages handled? Mm-hmm. Who should be there? Who shouldn't be there? How are their assets to be disposed of or organized? Have a living will, have these discussions, who should, right? So all of that, I think, can really, really, and there are people who specialize in the geriatric fields. Mm-hmm. Geriatric social workers can be oftentimes fantastic people to help with these types of planning.
So nowadays, with, you know, the Free Britney movement and everything, conservatorships and like wrestling control of someone's life has become a very popular conversation that I am assuming that you might have dealt with conservatorships or like families who say, look, we have to take control of our family member, but yet the system is so ripe for abuse. And so how do you approach those kinds of conversations about conserving or saying, you know, if, even if you're having those conversations and your family member won't go there with you, and how do you ensure, because I know for me, the idea of putting a family member into a full-time residential facility also ripe for abuse. And so talk to us about recognizing elder abuse, and how do you see sometimes in these family members that are kind of pretending to be there to take care of them, but are actually have some clandestine motives?
Yeah, no, and that is really a challenge, right? Because the elderly do become so isolated. Unfortunately, life is a full circle in that sense, similar to children. The elderly are at very similar risks. Mm-hmm. And at least in the child world, we have mandated reporting, where when a pediatrician sees or suspects, you know, some sort of neglect, they can at least get involved to try to help and make a difference. For the elderly, I would say it's similar, that it is really the professionals can often be very helpful at those wellness visits. At, you know, we really have to take a no wrong door approach, mm-hmm. because they may not be seen by a neurologist. They may not be seen by one of these people because there is a reluctance to go. So a primary care physician, for example, who's seeing certain signs of neglect, mm-hmm. can start that discussion to say, it sounds like, you know, perhaps it's harder for you to manage this person's care at home. Let's bring in a team. Let's start to evaluate. Let's get you some support so you're not feeling so overwhelmed. Because oftentimes neglect and abuse is coming because the caregiver is just frustrated themselves, right? They're at the end of their rope themselves as well. So helping that particular family or that person find some extra resources can be a really good start in that. And then also these decisions to conserve somebody are made with a medical team. And oftentimes there is legal representation as well. There are attorneys who specialize in that. I do evaluations, as you said, right? Oftentimes I would do a neuropsychological evaluation for a person and get some objective markers and collateral data from other doctors who've known this person, interview maybe some other family members outside of the person who's just bringing them in. So you sort of really collect a bunch of different pieces with their cognitive functioning, the data, results from the neurologist, along with the neuropsychologist, primary care physician, any other family members you may have access to, if they're still working, maybe with their permission or the family's permission, talking to an employer. So you collect all of these different pieces and you sort of look for consistencies or inconsistencies in the person's functioning across these different pieces of data. And decisions are made based on that, not on just a subjective opinion, because it is a big deal to take somebody's freedom away to conserve them, right? Mm-hmm. But we do want to keep them safe as well. So I know that there are circumstances where that has to be done. But I have to say that, fortunately, the system does not take that lightly. We have to do a fairly in-depth evaluation before we can just conserve somebody.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It is a huge deal. And I think, you know, I think the Britney Spears case is very illuminating about the problems within the system and the problems that can arise along the way. So to end today, I feel like this episode has had a lot of gloom and doom, but I think that's just because Alzheimer's disease is such a feared diagnosis. So end us today on, what are your favorite parts of your job? Like, what gives you hope that allows you to keep showing up and dealing with this very challenging disease state?
Yeah. Well, like I say to people, you know, they often ask, you know, because you do see a lot of gloom and doom with neuropsychology. But it's also about, it's not frivolous. There's nothing about our work that's frivolous. I don't have to spend the day making small talk. We get to be really real and we get to show up at a time. It is an honor to sort of be there as a support system for people at some of the hardest times in their life, right? And while it is a difficult situation, when you can align with them, at least you can be part of the solution. You can be part of helping navigate them through these really difficult situations. And you know, that really gives you a reason to wake up in the morning. You know the difference you're making. You know that you are being a support system for somebody else who's dealing with something huge, right? And being able to even just bring that knowledge, that guidance, giving somebody a plan to say, okay, this is a difficult situation, but here's always, right? So we always say you don't always have choice over the circumstances you end up in, but you have choice over how you get through those circumstances. And I think a lot of us professionals are part of that picture of helping people get through those circumstances in the best way possible.
Absolutely. There is so much that we could continue. I'm going to ask one last question. Talk to me about chronic infections and Alzheimer's disease, because I've seen some data that's like, you know, X percent of people with Alzheimer's disease have parasites that are undiagnosed, or they have this and they have that. Talk to me about just how infections can lead to dementias.
So I think infections in and of itself, unless you've sort of got something that crosses that blood-brain barrier, our brain is designed incredibly well. So there is a blood-brain barrier that most viruses and infections aren't going to necessarily get in there. But then there are things like encephalitis and things that can happen that impact the brain. But oftentimes, because I think you were mentioning this before we started talking today about, you know, Alzheimer's does lead to death. It is just one of the realities of the last stages of this progression of this illness is oftentimes in those late stages, people can develop infections because, again, you're not moving as much, right? So cardiovascularly, you can sort of start to have failure of different systems. You can develop sores because oftentimes people cannot swallow anymore. They can't eat. So they are bedridden. They can lose functioning, you know, bowel function. And so it's sort of those secondary infections that set up with any chronic illness, whether it's kidney disease or lung disease. So when you become more and more sedentary, a lot more infections and diseases can come in that can sort of be the cause of death for an elderly person.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for coming in and sharing such a wealth of knowledge about this disease state, and for just reminding us that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, and to really focus on our cognitive health all throughout life so that you reduce the risk of it happening in the future. So thank you so much for coming in and being a guest today. If our listeners want to find out more about you, where can they go and find more about the work that you do?
Yeah, I keep a fairly low profile. I don't have a website. I guess they can always email at shaliza@drshori.com. Or they can always reach us through, like I said, the platform that I'm building, which is just Epiphany with an A. So it's AEPIPHANY.com. And they can send a note through there and we'd be happy to help answer any questions. And you know, it's great talking with you today. I'm glad that you're bringing awareness to this difficult but important topic for us to sort of look at.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for coming in today and being a guest on the Lindsay Elmore Show.
My pleasure. Take care. Thanks.
The Lindsay Elmore Show is written and produced by me, Lindsay Elmore. Show segments are produced by Sue Procco and Derek Lugo. Sound design and editing is by Jive Media. Support the Lindsay Elmore Show by heading to lindsayelmore.com/podcast. Your contribution, no matter how big or how small, helps us to bring the best guests to the interview chair. Thank you so much for listening. Subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts. Share this and all of your favorite episodes with a friend and on social media. Be sure to tag @Lindsay Elmore Show and help us bring the pod to more people.